Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. 2009 ended on a gloomy note with news that the bookshop Borders had gone into administration, publishers' advances had slumped, and editors are making bonfires and piling their poor mid-list authors on top. So will things cheer up in 2010? With me to discuss this and to preview some of the titles we'll all be looking out for are Benedicta Page of the Trade Bible, the bookseller, Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website, and on the phone from Westminster, Michael White, who will be looking at how the publishing industry is squaring up to election year. Benedicta, first of all, was the picture I painted a bit too gloomy, do you think?
Well, there's no two ways about it. 2009 was a very tough year for the trade. It certainly saw its figures down. The industry wasn't as far down as many others, so people felt relatively relieved about that. Traditionally, everyone has always thought of books as being recession-proof, but every recession is different, and we weren't sure how we would fare. So I think we feel now that we know what the recession does to us. Publishers know a little bit more about how to commission for it, and people are adjusting accordingly. I would say it's a careful time. We hear that commissioning is slow. People are thinking very hard about the books that they buy. They're certainly not shelling out the kind of money that they used to shell out a few years ago. People are looking very hard at authors' sales figures for the previous book and having rather difficult negotiations, not very pleasant for any party, I think, with agents across the year where they, you know, negotiate the next books from that author and they say, I'm sorry, we've been paying that author too much.
I did hear of one poor author whose last advance was £150,000, whose current one is 15, and who'd had to accept it. Of course, it's not only a financial crunch, but we're in a bit of a technological revolution as well, aren't we?
Yes, we have. And maybe people don't necessarily think that as they walk around and see the very occasional person reading on their Sony e-reader or their Amazon Kindle or whatever reading device. But because we've been looking very closely at the example of the US, where they are perhaps 2 or 3 years ahead of us in terms of e-books. Publishers have seen really massive growth in the US. It's still not huge in terms of the overall market, but the speed of growth is fantastic. And given that other areas of the market aren't showing any growth, the fact that there is this huge growth in the States really makes people feel that we are in the very early stages of something that could revolutionise the industry, and that the picture of the trade, say, in 5 or 10 or 15 years' time could be quite different.
You mean people be walking around with Sony readers rather than books?
Well, we don't know what the technology will be that takes off because it's changing the whole time. I think that the thinking is that we're really waiting for the device that you need in your life anyway that you can also read books on. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, that is at perhaps some point in the future. Mm. Meantime, we are expecting, yes, people to be reading a lot more on their electronic reading devices because, you know, anecdotally, people who've been to the States lately, they walk around and they're just amazed at the number of people they see using these things. Mm. So, yes, we are really expecting a lot of growth in that in the next couple of years. It's a serious part of the industry and not just a small add-on, I think everybody is feeling.
Now, if we go to the immediate future, the first smoke signals go up at the Frankfurt Book Fair, don't they? Which, of course, has already happened. What were the signals that you got from there?
Well, there was one massive book there that really took the fair by storm, and it was, in fact, bought in the UK just on the eve of the fair by Pam Macmillan. It is Conversations with Myself, Nelson Mandela's private archives, his personal diaries, journals, letters, notes of meetings, which apparently he wrote, you know, every day of his life. Obviously, we've already had his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. This is going to be extremely personal, and apparently it sheds new light on the personal cost to him of his years at Robben Island. And there are letters about the deaths of his children, he lost two of his children. And also, I think it's going to cast new light on some of the political events and the political negotiations, both before and after the end of apartheid.
And that's in the autumn.
Yes, that's right. That's coming in the autumn. I think to tie in with his 90th birthday, and it's going to be a global publication and obviously be massive.
So going to the spring, let's just start with fiction. Sarah, last year was a big year for books by women. This year it all seems to be the male titans.
Yes, we've got new novels from all of the big male writers at the minute, I suppose. Ian McEwan has his new novel out, Martin Amis, Peter Carey, Don DeLillo, Jonathan Coe, the list sort of goes on and on.
Why do they all publish in the same year? I mean, they're all going to... Are we going to have spats at the Booker?
Well, I guess inevitably, yes, unless none of them make it onto the list, unless they've come out with stinkers, they don't actually make it on there.
Do we have any advance intelligence on whether they are?
The book about which there's been the most sort of pre-publication noise is probably Martin Amis's book, The Pregnant Widow. The suggestion is that it's the most autobiographical of his novels so far. It draws a lot on his sister who died. He said... I think it was a talk at the Richmond Book Festival. He said that her death was because of her promiscuity. This was the suggestion. Yeah, that she's quite a damaged woman. And, you know, it's a fairly inflammatory and sort of surprising thing to hear someone say about their sister.
He's got quite a lot to prove, hasn't he?
Yes, well, he really has, because, of course, the last book of his that came out was Yellow Dog, which was just really not very well received at all. Fairly trashed in the press, even, who, you know, tend to be quite friendly towards him, towards his writing. So this is quite an exciting one from him.
We've got quite a lot of topical novels, haven't we? Notably, the Ian McEwan is doing climate change.
Yes, this is his eco novel, apparently. And again, this is something that I suppose to an extent we've come to expect from him, particularly after Saturday, that he's somebody who is very much, he writes about the now, he's interested in what's happening now in the contemporary. And Saturday was his novel of terrorism post 9/11. And he has been making quite a lot of noise in the press over the last couple of years himself, writing articles on climate change and positioning himself as a commentator on climate change. And then this is the novel that's coming out of this fascination. And he's also somebody who has a history of being very interested in science. And so this, again, will no doubt feed into the novel, which presumably will draw quite a lot on the science of climate change. Mm-hmm. Also in that school, we have Richard Powers from the US, whose book Generosity is also very rooted in science. But in his case, Lindsay on the books desk has read it. And he called it...
It's about the neurology of capitalism,
that was
his phrase.
That's
so cute, isn't it?
It's a great phrase, yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, I guess I'll have to read the book to find out. He says, the book apparently is about a professor in whose creative writing class is a refugee whose family were all sorted in front of her, who's had an extremely difficult life, but yet who exudes happiness. And it's about the idea of what happiness is and where it comes from, where we find it, and its source. Lindsay's verdict on it was that it was a very interesting book. The ideas were absolutely fascinating. It's sort of Michael Crichton, but it's, you know, a really good Michael Crichton novel. Mm-hmm. But I think that he wasn't quite convinced that the prose quite carried the ideas. But either way, I mean, it sounds like a really interesting read. Mm. So certainly one that I'll be picking up when it comes out in
January. So now we've been entirely male-centred up till now. There are also lots of women, aren't there? Rose Tremaine.
Yes.
Got Trespass coming out in March, which is set in the south of France. Yes. Andrea Levy, who's actually had a very good year in 2009 with... her previous novel being put on television.
Oh, yes, of course.
This is a... The Long Song is about slavery. We've got another short story collection from Helen Simpson, which is always worth looking out for. Ben, are there any books that you're particularly interested in?
Yes, there are a couple of titles coming up that have really caught my eye. One of them is a book which I think is going to be published sometime in the summer. It's just quite recently been bought, and there's been a lot of fuss about it. Lots of publishers wanted it. I don't know if you remember the writer Emma Donoghue, who had successes some years back with novels like Slammerkin. She's off living in Canada now, and she's been a little bit off the scene for a couple of years. She has come up with the most amazing idea for a book. It's a novel called Room. And it's really, I think, inspired by those rather grisly cases, obviously the Joseph Fritzl case, where a woman was kept captive and her children were also captive with her in this enclosed space. And I think it's drawing on that kind of theme, but looking at it from through the eyes of the child who has been protected by his mother and knows nothing about the outside world or the reality of his own circumstances are. So it's a compelling idea, I think. And of course, we know that she has a very good track record as a literary writer, so you can expect her to handle it really well, I think. So that's something to look out for, I think, towards the middle of the year.
Sarah?
Well, as well as you mentioned Helen Simpson, and I'm a real fan of hers, and her new collection is coming out in, I think, in May. And that, like the Ian McEwan book, is apparently going to be based a lot around climate change and the themes of climate change. She's somebody who we think of as being writing about the family and the domestic and sort of the small scale. So it'll be really interesting to see where she goes with this and how she tackles this sort of very, you know, well, global issue. But really, for me, the book that I'm most excited about is the new novel by E.L. Doctorow, Homer and Langley, which is coming out in January. And this is just a fantastic book. I mean, I think that he is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, and it's wonderful to see him still writing into the 21st century. I'm sure that a Nobel is somewhere around the corner. And the book is, it's a great story. It's about these two brothers, Homer and Langley Collier, who lived in a house on Fifth Avenue. It's all based on a true story. Over the period of their lives, they became more and more reclusive. Homer was blind and Langley sort of looked after him. And the house, which had been a beautiful, grand Fifth Avenue mansion, becomes silted up with the debris of the American century, I suppose. You know, there's a Model T Ford in the dining room, and, you know, guns on the wall, and newspapers, every day's newspapers, just piling up and piling up and piling up. And then what happened in the end is that Langley, the sighted brother, died in a collapse of rubbish within the house, and Homer starved to death, sort of stuck in the house. And so he novelises this incredible New York story in the way that only he can. And again, it's interesting because it's, rather than his other novels, which are expansive about, you know, they take in the state of America by looking outwards, this one takes it in by looking inwards. Mm. And it's a phenomenal book. So that's definitely the one I'm most excited about. Mm-hmm.
So there's one of the big guns to look out for. Ben, we're particularly interested in The Guardian on first books. Do you have any advance intelligence?
I do, yes. It's a strong spring for first novels. I mean, obviously the first months of the year are the traditional time for the new novelists to come out. You might think that this would be an area that we very much cut back because of the recession, but I'm happy to say that that is not the case. There are a couple of interesting ones that have come to our attention at the bookseller. One of them is a crime novel called Blacklands, and it's a very dark crime novel about a young boy whose uncle was the victim of a child murderer back in the day, and this boy starts to write to the convicted killer in prison to try and find out where he buried the body on the moor. So that's a very dark story, but it's a well accomplished one.
Who's that by?
It's by Belinda Bauer. And then coming up in March, I think, is an interesting first novel from a writer called Artish Tazir. It's called The Temple Goers, and it's very interesting. It's a novel set in contemporary Delhi, and it's about a sort of privileged young man from, you know, the English-speaking elite. He's an aspiring writer, and he strikes up a kind of dangerous friendship with his personal trainer, who comes from a very different background. So it's one of those sort of dangerous friendships that lure you into difficult territory. And it's a very compelling novel. They're calling him an Indian Bret Easton Ellis. And that's a good one coming up in the spring.
And of course, I'm always interested in following up on people who've been on our previous lists. And this year they include Trezza Azzopardi, whose fourth novel, The Songhouse, is out. And Catherine O'Flynn. Sarah, she's a fascinating writer, isn't she?
Yes, she's absolutely great. And I think the new novel from her is a very exciting proposition. Again, like her first novel, What Was Lost, it's Birmingham-based. It's, again, to do with sort of ghosts and disappearances, people going missing. She's moved publisher now. She's moved from the small Birmingham press that published her first novel to Viking. So she'll have a much bigger marketing budget behind her, one imagines. And it might be a really big book for her.
Moving on to non-fiction, 2010 will of course be the year of the general election. So should we expect a slew of political books? Guardian political writer Michael White joins us on the phone from Westminster. But first, Benedicta, I don't see very many in the catalogues at the moment.
No, you would expect more than we're seeing at the moment. It's possible that we'll see a few more coming in as we go into looking at what's coming up in April and May and sort of closer to the election date. But it does look quite light at the moment. I don't know whether people are thinking, well, people aren't excited enough to go out and buy these books, or they won't be long enough to sell them. I don't know. Or maybe, you know, they'll be coming, but just a little bit later on in the year.
Mm-hmm. Michael, tell us a bit about the ones that we know about.
We're all waiting Tony Blair's. That's the big blockbuster. Blair has promised not to publish it while Brown is still in power. 6 months ago, you may say. Blair can't be candid about his relationship with Brown, which is what everybody wants to know now that we know Brown rather better. So he's got to wait. And of course, other former cabinet ministers, well, there aren't many of them, who are going to be providing blockbusters. We've had the others. And of course, with the Tories, it's all too fluid. So we're kind of in a sort of nodal point there. It'll get better after Blair, I guess. And when Blair is due, nobody knows. He says he's writing it, but he's a busy boy, isn't he? Mm.
So we're going to rely on Andrew Rawnsley for the end of the party, as his book is called.
Yeah, well, Rawnsley's original book, Servants of the People, has held up pretty well, actually, because he made quite a lot. It was a novelty in those days, hard to imagine, that this tension between Brown and Blair, this curious relationship, and we've every expectation that he'll probably do another good job wrapping it up as it ends. So his timing is quite good too. I'm quite optimistic about that one.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of Tory books, one coming up in January, Tim Bales.
Yeah, I've not clapped eyes on it or seen it. On the other hand, the people who are writing about it on the sort of blurbs you get in places like Amazon these days, Phil Cowley, Douglas Hurd, David Willetts, they all say this is a good book by Bale, and they're good, successful writers. Well, Norman Fowler wasn't. He almost killed the memoir market single-handed with his memoirs.
So this is a survey book, isn't it, which is looking at the whole history of the Conservative Party from Thatcher till now.
Yeah, well, many people have written the histories, the heavens of the Conservative Party. John Ranelagh springs to mind, somebody else. It's a great challenge, Robert Blake, the great Robert Blake, of course. But he's moving, you know, what's happened since Thatcher? Well, I always call the war of Thatcher's succession, by which I mean many in her party thought she was illegitimately deposed, not by the electorate, but by a bunch of cowardly backbench Tory MPs trying to save their own skin when they weren't fit to wipe her boots. I don't exaggerate. This is the language they do use. And we spent almost until David Cameron fighting a war of legitimacy. Ken Clark was turned down as leader because he was the man who said, Margaret, you've got to go. Typical Ken Clark, Frank. And only towards the end of Michael Howard did you start to see the wounds of the Tory party bind up. And then, of course, Cameron is holding it together. It's a fragile coalition. But he looks like winning. So they like winners in the Tory party, mm-hmm. and they're fed up with not having won enough lately.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Philip Blond's Red Tory, which is coming up in April?
He seems what we call a bright young man.
He's head of Demos, isn't he?
Well, I believe no. He's got his own think tank, which is called Res Publica. Never trust a man who resorts to Latin or a trade union or Norwich Union, an insurance company either. I always think it's a rascally dodge. But he's one of these bright young serviceable people who come up with ideas. He's a social Tory. He believes the Tory party is not about meritocracy and widening wealth gaps and merchant bankers getting half a million a year bonuses. Why is half a million? 10 million. He believes in with Disraeli and Shaftesbury and Rab Butler and the One Nation Tories of the post-war era that, you know, it's a one nation party. We're all in this together. When George Osborne said that at the Tory party conference, don't know if he meant it, that's the kind of Toryism Philip is interested in. He's a good talker. He does sound a bit like a university lecturer rather than a practical politician. And my hunch is that he'll have his moment in the sun, and like a lot of these think tanks, he'll disappear quietly.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Ben, we've got a lot of books about the credit crunch still.
Last year, there were plenty of them, and they sold really well, and people did go out and buy them in large numbers, so publishers have got more to come. And it's kind of moving to the next stage of things. We've got Robert Peston's The New Capitalism, looking at how we're all going to function in the wake of the global meltdown and the new era in which we find ourselves. And then there's a book by Michael Lewis, who wrote Liar's Poker, had a big success with that a few years ago, and it's called The Big Short. And it takes a rather interesting perspective on the global meltdown by looking at the financiers who predicted it, saw that it was coming, saw the flaws in the system, tried to warn people, and also, you know, made money themselves out of it.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, on the literary front, we've got a book from John Lanchester of the LRB.
Yes, his book is called Whoops, is the title, and the subtitle is Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay. And he stands alone for me as the only person who's ever been able to make me think that I might have partially understood the credit crunch. He's a brilliant, brilliant journalist in the LRB. I always look forward to his pieces. And I think that his he wrote two articles about the credit crunch, one beforehand, which was called City Filly, about why everybody loved the city and why it was all going to go horribly wrong. And that was in January 2008. And then in October 2008, he wrote a piece called City Phobia about, you know, why everyone hated the city and why everything had gone wrong. And they sort of bookended, you know, the crisis in a way. And his book version of it, I think, is just going to be a really clear, fascinating read. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Now, Mike, you said a bit earlier, never trust a man who resorts to Latin, which brings us to another of the themes of the year, which appears to be books which indeed do resort to Latin and Greek, which reference the classics.
I'm fascinated by the classical world as I get older. I'm keen to buy these sorts of books. And, you know, a book by Ferdy Mount, which I think is the book you have in mind, he's a terrific writer, wrote good political books, and a wonderful memoir called Cold Cream, which I read during my summer holiday this year. Cold Cream was what his poor, long-dead mother used to make him help put on her face, and it obviously was a powerful memory. He's a very smart guy, Ferdy Mount, former editor of the TLS.
He was an advisor to Margaret Thatcher as well, wasn't he, at one
point? No need to spoil his career when I was saying such nice things about him. There you go again. Yes, he was. He's very funny in this memoir I just mentioned about being summoned one day. And she says, well, you're a wordsmith, Ferdy. You can make my speeches sound better. And she knows he's not one of us. Do you remember that phrase?
Yes.
She used to use, Claire? But he's clever and he does words. And he's there like a sort of holy fool in the centre of the Thatcher years. And he comes to respect her. He comes to admire her energy, her idealism, her commitment, even though she terrifies him. Uh-huh. He's a real bit of national treasure, Ferdy Mount, and I am much in favour of books about the ancient world. What an extraordinary world it was.
His book is called Full Circle, The Rebirth of the Classical World in the 21st Century. And it's one of several. There are lots of them that reference the Iliad in particular, one of the first of which is Caroline Alexander's The War That Killed Achilles, which recasts the Trojan War as a catastrophe rather than as glory. Sarah, is this something that you've been spotting all over the place?
There has been a move in recent years to revisit the classical world. I mean, I guess the big book of last year was Robert Harris's book, Lustrum.
Which was very, very overt, wasn't it? I mean, it was
yes.
dedicated to Peter Mandelson, and who was, you know... There were lots of jokes about Ciceronian penchants for expensive houses and things, weren't there?
Yes, there were. I have a sort of suspicion that this is shares a sort of lineage with the rise of historical fiction, the popularity of that now, which is that we're all feeling a bit shaky and destabilised by, you know, whether you want to pick climate change or the credit crunch as your catastrophe of choice. And it's very reassuring to go back to something that we know is safe because it's embalmed in history. And so I think there is a reaching back to the past and to something that we can kind of touch that isn't going to all fall apart in our hands. And perhaps that explains why it's been such a publishing phenomenon.
Tom Holland's book on the late Roman Republic, Rubicon, 5 years ago, was a bestseller. You can still get it in the bookshop. Fantastically well-written book. Mm. And Mary Beard, people like that write really well.
Sarah, your particular interest is poetry. Tell us a bit about what's coming up here.
Yes, it looks set to be a really good year for poetry. And while we had all the men writing in fiction, a lot of the great poetry next year is going to come from women. And probably the first thing that people are going to be excited about is Caroline Duffy's first book of poems since her election to the poet laureateship. It's just called Love Poems, and it's... I'm not entirely sure whether it's totally taken from her back catalogue, as it were, or whether there are a couple of new poems in there. But she is sort of being positioned, I think, as the great sort of contemporary laureate of love. And she won the T.S. Eliot Prize with Rapture, her collection on a single relationship. And she's always written very beautifully and very movingly about love. And so that's happening in January, and that's going to be a big collection, I think. Then also in January, we've got Gwyneth Lewis, who's the National Poet for Wales. She's written a very interesting-sounding collection called A Hospital Odyssey. And this is where you were talking about sort of science in fiction. This is science and poetry here, and it's a voyage through illness and healing, which draws on recent kind of developments in medicine and biological research and stem cell research and cancer. it treats the body as a continent, I suppose, which is a fairly familiar idea in poetry. But it voyages through the body and through the mind, how the mind and the body relate in the context of illness. And then we also have Fleur Adcock, who's a great figure in 20th century poetry. It's her first collection for 10 years, and she goes back again to those subjects which we're so familiar with about the family. She's a great writer on the family. And also she talks about New Zealand, which is where she's from. It's her native country. So I'm really looking forward to all of those. But then obviously there are great men writing in poetry too. So one that I think everyone's going to be really interested in is Danny Absey's new collection, Two for Joy. Danny's wife, Joan, they've been married for 50 years, and she was killed in a car crash in 2005. And he wrote this incredible memoir of loss after her death called The Presence, which won, I think, the National Welsh Book Award, I think. And it was Wales Book of the Year, that was it. And it's incredibly heartfelt, moving. And this new collection, he's a couple of years down the line, and he returns to their marriage, but this is about the joy of married life and the pleasure that he took in it. It's another collection of love poems, I suppose, but from a different perspective. So I think that'll be, rich and warm and a wonderful collection to pick up in February. We've also got a new collection from Derek Walcott. This is newsworthy because the last time we heard from Derek Walcott, it was in the race for the Oxford Poetry Professorship, which he eventually withdrew from because of all claims and counterclaims about what he had or hadn't done in his past. But this is him going back to what he does best, writing poetry. And again, returning to his traditional subject, which is the Caribbean and the colonial legacy. But the poetry collection that I'm most looking forward to, probably, I think I've probably said enough now, is Robin Robertson's new collection, The Wrecking Liner. He won the Forward Prize for his collection, Swithering, and he is one of our great writers of nature. He's fantastic on nature and the natural world and the place of people within the natural world. And nature was really, it was the theme of poetry in 2009, and so it's interesting to see it carrying on into 2010.
Mm-hmm. Now, Benedicta, it's not only in poetry that nature is going to be big this year, is it?
No, there's definitely a lot of nature writing, quite literary nature writing, to look forward to this year. Publishers are seeing certain trends as part of the recession. There's the downturn, there's a sort of return to thinking about the domestic, thinking about the home, perhaps looking inwardly, having the values as, the capitalist world crashes around us. And so there's some very interesting nature writing happening, and it's a clear trend. I just picked out a couple of books to talk about, but there are many more, I think. There's an interesting looking one called A Year in the Woods, The Diary of a Forest Ranger, and it's by someone called Colin Elford, and that's coming up in March. He's a ranger who has been in the forests doing his job for many, many years, and it's just the diary of a year, his observations, his thoughts, as he goes about his work and sees the natural world around him. And then there's another one by the Scottish writer Andrew Gregg that's coming up in April, called At the Loch of the Green Corrie. And that's about a journey made on a fishing trip made in memory of a friend. And it's a sort of meditative book about friendship and also, of course, about the landscape that he sees. And I imagine that's going to be a very beautiful book.
Mm-hmm. And one I'm actually looking forward to most, I think, is Bugs Britannica, which might sound like a joke, but it is a follow-up to the wonderful Birds Britannica, and it's by Richard Mabey and Peter Marrow, and it's coming from Chatto. Just finally, is it going to be a good year for the memoir? We can't let a preview go ahead without talking about memoirs, can we?
No, well, I think the memoirs, really, that's been the story of the first decade of the 21st century, I think. It was a category that barely existed, really. And I think for me, it was Lorna Sage who kicked it off with her wonderful book, Bad Blood, back in 2000. This idea of you don't have to be famous, you don't have to be in the public eye to be able to write a memoir. And that's definitely something that we're still seeing this year. And probably the one that I'm looking forward to most out of those is from Rupert Thompson, who's a novelist. This is his first non-fiction book. It's called This Party's Got to Stop. And it's the story of his family following the death of his father. His mother had died when he was very young. And he and his two brothers going back to the family home in Eastbourne. And the story of half a year or 8 months after the death of their father, before the house is sold, and how that all plays out. And it's again, it's small scale, but fascinating, beautifully written, and in all of these books, again, since Lorna Sage, it's been about the quality of the writing and the way in which novelists are perhaps better placed than anyone else to be able to read and translate their own lives. And so, yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to that one.
Benedicta, another one you've been keen on is Fatima Bhutto's. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I think this sounds very, very interesting. Fatima is the niece of Benazir Bhutto, and there's a book coming up from her called Songs of Blood and Sword. And I think it's a sort of intimate family memoir about, you know, being within that political dynastic family in Pakistan. And her father was, in fact, murdered when she was in her teens, in the mid-1990s, I believe. And it's very much a sort of voyage by her into understanding the complex politics of that family and of the country. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be published by Jonathan Cape. So I think it's going to be a very, you know, literary memoir and very interesting by the sound of it.
So there we have the public and the private of memoir, which brings us to the one I'm actually dying to read, which is Christopher Hitchens' Both Sides Now, Some Confessions of a Divided Self, which is going to be out in May, just in time for the Hay Festival, where he will no doubt be doing his usual turn. That's it for our preview of 2010. Thanks to Benedicta Page, Mike White and Sarah Crown. We'll be back to our normal programme next week. I'm Claire Armistead and our producer was Scott Corley. Goodbye.